Welcome, folks, back to another episode of Mention and Dispatches. We're into season seven. We're getting well into season seven that will run roughly up till the holidays of 2021, and then we'll take a break over the holidays and come back afterwards with season eight. But right now, we're focused on the here and now. We're focused on season seven, and we've got some special guests tonight. Our primary topic tonight, we're going to be talking about the differences between professional and hobby game design. That's something that's come up a bunch over the last couple of months between the Dragoons' involvement with Connections Online and some of the things that we've done with the Georgetown University Wargaming Society. This is an area where we're starting to cover a little more overlap, and so we brought in a couple of folks to talk about that a little bit. And so with me tonight, speaking of Georgetown University Wargaming Society, we have their president, Lexi. Welcome to Mention and Dispatches.
Hey, Brant. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. We have the guy that, you know, look, Goose is all his fault. Sebastian, welcome back to Mention and Dispatches.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure to be on here with you guys.
And we love that you've made some time for us, especially around your schedule. And then we had to remind Chris this afternoon or this evening at about 8 o'clock. Hey, don't forget you're on the podcast tonight. But Chris, our good buddy Chris Weave, is back. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. It's good to be back. And thank you very much for reminding me.
Yeah, well, otherwise, it's just going to be me and Sebastian and Lexi. And, you know, that was going to be way too highbrow for the audience. We needed to bring you in to help, you know, bring it down a little.
Glad I can be of assistance.
Absolutely. So, Chris, there's actually a little bit of news on your front in this world of sci-fi and hard science fiction and some gaming, as well as the fiction area. You're going to be taking over a pretty well-known website in that world. Can you give us a little bit about the site and the backstory about how you ended up in this place?
Sure. So I am taking over the Atomic Rockets of the Space Patrol website that was created and put together by Winchell Chung. Those of us who have a little bit of gray hair may remember that Winchell, back in high school, did the artwork for Steve Jackson Games' Ogre. After that, he was a programmer in the computer game industry when the computer game industry was just getting started. I think he worked for Avalon Hill when they briefly had a computer game division and stuff like that. And he's been a computer geek his entire life. He started the Atomic Rockets of the Space Patrol website as sort of a spinoff of the science fiction war games mailing list that I created called SF ConSML. I did that back in the 1990s, and Winch has been on that mailing list forever. And it was his sort of attempt to take a hard science approach at science fiction space combat. And it's had a tremendous impact. A lot of writers use it as a reference. The authors of The Expanse, for instance, said that they couldn't have written The Expanse if they didn't have access to Winchell's website. So Winchell is very ill. This is a recent diagnosis. He sent me an email a couple of Saturdays ago saying, hey, do you know anybody that would be willing to take it over? Can you help me find somebody? And I said, well, you know, I'd be willing to take it over. And he said, well, you were my first choice, but I didn't want to presume, which is a very, you know, I my response was, of course, I'll take this over, Winch. I'll, of course, take it over. So it's at projectrow.com. That'll take you to the website if you haven't heard of it before. Right now, it's just a matter of getting it, sort of getting the stuff that needs to get transferred to me. Then getting it archived so there will always be Winch's version of that website available. And then once I've done those two things, I will figure out exactly how to continue updating it moving forward. So best wishes to Winch, who I've known for, you know, 25 years. It's a real shame that this is happening. I think I'm up to the challenge, and it's, you know, he entrusted me with his legacy. So I take that very seriously.
That's a bit of a big deal, because that site's been around, like you said, for quite a while. And so the Atomic Rockets site, we've got it linked to the episode here, so you guys can click on over there and go check it out and go see where it is now, but be able to keep tabs on it for folks that are fans of hard sci-fi, which we know we got quite a bit of you guys out there. you'd be able to just hit that link and go check out Atomic Rockets, and just know that it's going to take Chris a little bit of time to settle in and take this thing on, but that's the future of that site and where that community is going a little bit. So Chris, I hope this ends up, as most labors of love do, that this does manage to bring some joy to you, helping keeping Winchell's legacy alive, like you said, but also that it doesn't significantly impact your ability to do crazy things like the next Connections Online when we get around to doing that next year. So.
No, it's not going to affect that at all. In fact, this is consistent with a bunch of plans that I had. And I had that conversation with Chris Carlson, co-designer of Harpoon, the other day, who's a friend of mine. He actually hired me to replace him at the last place I worked before I came to where I am now. And he said, do you have time for this? And I said, my response to that was, it's very consistent with some of the things that I've wanted to start doing online. And it's going to fit in well with a bunch of that stuff. And I know, it's one of those things I'm going to have to cut stuff, and I know what's being cut. So I was in the process of sort of transitioning away from some current projects. Anyway, this is going to be the new project. So certainly not going to allow me to just go and, kick back and watch TV. But it should be, there's a plan going forward. I just need to figure out exactly how to implement it. It'll be good. It'll be good.
So Lexi, you see, you stick around Wargaming long enough, you're going to be able to drop all kinds of names just casually into conversation the same way Chris does. Lexi is here. President of Georgetown University Wargaming Society. So this is Sebastian, is this two or three presidents in a row of Goose that we've now had on the podcast?
This is our second.
Okay. We've had both at this point. We're batting 1,000. Lexi, give us a quick snapshot of what's coming up for Goose over the next few months. You've got the webinar series that everybody's doing on Tuesday nights, and y'all have got to be getting creative with getting people to come talk, because you invited me a couple of weeks ago. So there's, you got to be scraping the bottom of the barrel here at some point, right?
Hi, yeah. So I would definitely say a lot of great events. I would not characterize them as bottom of the barrel. And we even have some, I would call repeat offenders who we've roped into doing two or three, or in a Volko's case, there I am with the name drop in, doing multiple iterations for us, multiple game sessions and webinars. Coming up in October, we've got Being a Game Designer is Not Unlike Being a Middle School Student, being led by Kathleen Mercury. We've got one that I'm excited for, Wargaming at Canadian Forces College. Always exciting to hear what our Canadian allies are doing. We have a virtual game day with Hearts of Iron 4. So anyone who is on our Discord, you'll see the links and the signups go out for that. That'll be on the 17th. And then I'll be moderating, and Lauren Butita will be hosting Wargaming and Girl Security on October 19th. And then, of course, Volko will be speaking, doing a webinar on October 28th called Paper Time Machines, Board Games That Take Us Elsewhere and Elsewhen. So I'm always excited to hear what Volko has to say, especially in the tabletop and board game realm. And I'm assuming we'll talk a little bit of Vassal during that as well. So anyone who's online, who wants to sign up, of course, go to our webpage. But moving along from our October series and looking at the rest of the fall, we're focused a lot on educational war games and as well as professional war games and how we can use those with some of our professors. And maybe Sebastian can speak to this a little bit, but we've definitely seen a lot of our professors at Georgetown warming up to the idea of using hobby war games in their classes.
Sebastian, sounds like she's teeing you up here.
Yeah, so we've been trying to get more involved with other courses as we have returned to campus this semester at Georgetown, both in the undergrad program and the graduate program. And Lexi can talk about a little bit about the effort that Goose has been supporting other faculty that she actually led. So I'll actually toss it back to her on that note.
Sebastian, I was setting you up so well to talk about all of your great professor friends. But yeah, so Georgetown, in the program I'm in and Sebastian actually went through called the Security Studies Program, has a variety of concentrations. We've had professors from the intelligence concentration, the military operations concentrations ask us to host various game nights for their higher level courses. So think not your like intro to intelligence, but hey, what are complex intelligence situations? As well as just kind of the general consensus from some of the associate and higher professors asking, hey, is there going to be some sort of simulation that I can send my intro or first semester students to kind of get them warmed up to the idea of, hey, not only are we back to in-person school, but this is how we interact. I mean, a lot of people are coming out of doing college, their undergrad online, didn't really have in-person interviews, and simulations are going to be a great way for those students to get involved and make sure they have the right speaking candor, make sure they can formulate ideas, debate, all that good, healthy stuff.
Make them all interact with each other.
Exactly. And if it's for a grade, they have to, right?
Sebastian, with some of the, I was wanting to ask, obviously Goose has gotten a fairly high profile amongst the professional and academic gaming communities, in large part because of the webinar series, which has been fantastic. It's a ton of fun to watch and to check out and to be a part of. That I'm curious how much, if at all, you've had requests or people pinging you from other schools, other universities. Hey, how did you get this off the ground? How did you get up and running? What kind of support did you get from the administration? What did you have to fight for? What did they give you? Is this something that we're going to start seeing pop up at other schools around the country? Or is this something that's kind of limited to somewhere like a Georgetown or a Mercyhurst because of the specific academic programs that are kind of tied to these, to something like Goose?
So on that note, I wouldn't say like Goose is the first of its kind. There have been wargaming programs within security studies programs before Goose. MIT had one and still has one. Duke University, which has a broader mandate about game design, has one. And there are other schools that sit between the commercial game design programs to sort of the national security wargaming establishment, where Goose sort of sits in the middle and leans to the national security and defense side. And we've collaborated with those organizations, and we have also done a lot of work with our uniform and professional military education institutions like Marine Corps University, Krulak Center, Army War College has been fantastic supporters. So has Naval War College and Command General Staff College, where you know James and Mike, who yep. do fantastic work there. So we've done a lot of collaboration, and I believe it was a year ago where both Caitlin Leong, who was our former president, and myself, we wrote two pieces on how Goose started and how educational wargaming can add to the campus. And my piece to the Australian Defense College was on the basis of how do you start a program like this? How do you start an initiative where you can leverage educational wargaming? And we've, as an organization, not just me, have been trying to help others who've been trying to do similar things in New Zealand, Australia, Canada, with our colleagues across the pond in the UK and other places. But a lot of it's just learning from each other. It's not like we have all the answers. A lot of times we tell them, hey, these are some of the struggles. But a lot of times, just like in games, they're contextual, right? One of the big things here at the security studies program that both Lexi, myself, and Goose overall have a great advantage is that our administration is incredibly supportive, allowing us to do a lot of things that student organizations normally don't do. And that's been, you know, such a boon to us. And we also have the great geographic advantage of being smack dab right next to the Pentagon, next to Quantico, not too far from Army War College and other colleagues. And there is such a great concentration of wargaming talent in the DoD here in the National Capital Region, which is just, you know, I mean, an abundance of riches in a lot of ways. So that's allowed us to do a lot of things. And we are trying to help with other organizations to do the same.
Plus, you got the Castle guys at National Defense University right there as well.
Yeah, can't forget Scott and Caitlin, who all do amazing work over there at NDU. So, like I said, there's so much talent here, and we here at Georgetown are really sort of blessed to be able to leverage all the experts in the field and your colleagues of mine at RANS, DNA, and other places. They're fantastic.
Yeah. So it geography definitely does make a difference, especially in this case. With regards to some of the differences in the hobby versus the professional game world, obviously, I think folks intuitively understand there are some differences there. I think many hobby folks can appreciate the idea of war games in a training context within the military. This allows you to exercise those tactical brain muscles to get better at your decision making in the heat of battle. I think a lot of military folks, once there's a little bit of explanation of kind of some military processes, the hobby guys also sort of understand where wargaming fits in the military decision making process, or in the Marine Corps. I think it's the Marine Corps planning process, I think is the doctrinal name for it there. That the idea of using a war game in that decision process for the purpose of making decisions about your plan, which course of action you want to end up with, folks generally understand that. But when we start talking about rehearsals, analytical war games, some of the very high level strategic ones, now we're off into a realm that the hobbyists don't often see. And so when we start talking about some of the differences between what the hobby guys do and what the pro guys do, obviously there's some similarities. There's going to be some big differences. Sebastian, in you've talked about this before in other places. You've talked about it some on our podcast before as well. In teaching your war game design class that you teach there at Georgetown, you start folks off playing some hobby war games. And so what are some of those kind of universal lessons that you're hoping they take from those hobby war games that you put in front of them that you hope that they're going to apply in the professional realm later? And maybe Lexi, as a graduate of your class, can also chime in on here as well.
Now that you mention it, Lexi is currently in my class, not that she needs to learn anything about game design from me. But in terms of teaching game design to newcomers and aspiring designers, I found there was no replacement for being exposed to both professional and commercial games. Commercial games allow you to understand how games work in the broadest sense of how players engage with a topic, whether that's Sushi Go or, the Seven Years War. It's about how to understand games enabling and constraining decision spaces. And that is the first step for game designers to understand, to understand that dynamic and how games and players engage in a dynamic way. So I found that to be the first building block. And then you can build towards other things as you get them up to speed as they are designing their own professional educational games. And I'll pass it to Lexi as she's about to start her own process in my class this fall.
Yes. So as Sebastian said, I'm currently in the class, and don't let him fool you. He is teaching me a lot about educational games, historical gaming, mainly how to keep to my deadlines and actually keep a journal of what I go through and design. So it's been awesome thus far. When I think of commercial games and what they lend, not just to students in an educational capacity, but also for purposes of analysis, et cetera, I really think about the science of games. And I look at commercial games as the way to kind of extract that science in a very palpable, user-friendly manner. So Sebastian mentioned Sushi Go. I refer to Burger Up a lot. My favorite is Unstable Unicorns, where you're trying to build a deck. You've got a lot of good commercial games that have some of these same underlying mechanics and interactions that come through in your more tactical or operational war games. And for me, when I look at commercial games and how important it is to keep playing them and keep fresh in those mechanics, it really comes down to, hey, can I play this with my partner on a Friday night and, count it as doing research either for school or work?
Chris, you've been around the block quite a bit in a variety of different professional contexts. Not asking you to list any of them here because we don't have any of you here as official representatives of your organizations, just here as folks who know a bunch about game design in these different realms. As you look at your decades of experience in the hobby game world, as well as the decades of experience in the pro world, what are some of the big similarities that you see in the design between the two? We'll come back around in a few minutes to talk about some of the differences. What are some of those similarities that you see that are important to keep in mind as you're working in that professional context?
So the similarities I see are, first of all, you need to have an objective as to what you're trying to accomplish with the game. And it's easy to say that if you're doing a game for, you know, commercial purposes or something like that, the objective is to have fun. But it's actually probably a little bit more, you need to be a little bit more specific than that, to sort of figure out what's going on there. You know, what do you mean by fun? Are you aiming for a specific length of time? There's no game out there that everybody's going to like. There's, you know, some people like short games, some people like long games, some like complex games, some like simple games. So you're never going to be able to make a game that everybody's going to like. You need to figure out what type of game you need to make. And that's something that's very much, you know, you've got a different objective from the standpoint of fun isn't what you're trying to do with a professional game usually, although there's another word for fun, that's engagement. And so you want your game to be engaging with people, and with commercial games, you do that by making it fun. You also need to pay attention to the players. Like, who do you think the player is? What do you think the player knows going in? That's one of the things that a well-done war game, a well-done game of any sort, gives the player synthetic experience. You don't have to understand the entire process behind something in order to be able to do it, because you've baked that into the rules, right? You don't have to be able to understand how to do logistics for a core if you're playing a ground combat game, because you've baked it into the rules and you've made those abstractions necessary to let players play the game. So those are the two similarities that come to mind to start off with. Always, you have to start with an objective. You have to sort of define what your problem is, and that will tell you, you know, that'll tell you when you've achieved the game, right? When you've met your victory condition for designing the game, and you have to think about the players.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. You mentioned the idea of how do you get people to engage with the game? And that was actually some of the research that I had done back when I was working on a doctorate, you know, over 10 years ago at this point. Part of the research that I had done was the differences in learning uptake based on varying levels of interactivity in what was in the material being presented to you. And at the high level, for the most interactive, we had folks actually playing a video. We were using VBS2. We gave them a quick tutorial on how to do the buttonology, and then turned them loose on the course material that was kind of scripted within the VBS2 scenario. And we had that versus a variety of other less interactive tools. And really, one of the biggest things that we learned is the interface is your make or break piece of the learning in the engagement model there. Because if people don't already know the interface you're putting in front of them, then the learning time you have will be taken up with them learning the interface, not the material that you're putting in front of them. And so for folks that were already comfortable with the WASD buttons for navigation within a game, they fell right into it. They went into paying attention to what was on the screen in front of them. For folks that didn't already know the interface in the game, they were having to understand how to actually move stuff around in the game rather than learning the material that was kind of in front of them. And that's one of the reasons why something like the built-in PowerPoints in a web browser, you know, all those annoying mandatory training that everybody has to do for corporate America every 6 months, why that interface works. Everybody knows what the right arrow button does, you know, that moves you to the next screen in the presentation, and then here comes the quiz. If you don't have to teach people the interface, if you don't have to teach people the mechanism with which they engage with the material, they go straight into focusing on the material. And so I think that's a big important lesson in there that sometimes might get lost in an educational context, which is one of many different professional contexts there.
I think hobby games have sort of the same kind of idea with it. I often say that the victory condition the first time you play a game is to understand the rules at the end. And I know that, like, my hobby game group back when I lived in the D.C. area, we played a lot of stuff double blind that wasn't designed to be played double blind. So we had a referee and a partition in between, and the referee is going back and forth. And you know, we've got two maps set up. And I finally had to put my foot down and say, look, the first time we play this, the first time we play a new game, I'm not going to play the first time double blind. I'm just not. And it's like, oh, but they're so much better double blind. It's like, yeah, but the first time I'm playing, it's not about winning the game. It's not about that. It's about understanding the rules at the end. And when you add that extra complexity of trying to figure out the fog of war, double blind is great for fog of war, but I need to understand the mechanics. I need to know, like, you know, I need to have the equivalent of all that stuff that you learn in basic and you learn in your A schools and all that other stuff, right? I've never actually been a tank commander before. So if I'm going to play a tank game, I need to sort of understand how tanks work in this game. So I think it's the same sort of idea. And that actually goes to one of the things that you always have to worry about in situations like this. If you tell me that I've got a half hour to teach the game, I will design a much different game than if you tell me I've got a day to teach,
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, no, it's absolutely true. I imagine some of that learning on ramp, Sebastian, this goes back to why you use one of the versions of Risk in your intro to wargaming class, isn't it?
Yeah, so I've always talked about Game of Thrones Risk, everyone, mainly because it's such a great intro game to understand really basic mechanics. And there is a certain familiarity to Risk as a system, as a franchise of games. And for those who come into my class, I don't know if they are professional wargamers already, like Lexi, or if you never played a game and Risk is the only game you've ever known. So I have to sort of cater to the most common denominator in the sense that I assume they don't have any gaming experience. And if they do, that's great, and we'll work from there. But the first time, we often play stuff like Game of Thrones Risk, Battle for Moscow, things that are able to expose them to different game mechanics and game ideas like combat result tables, step losses, movement restrictions because of terrain, the use of cards, the use of imperfect information, and player behavior. And that's all really important.
Lexi, does he still cheat?
It's hard to tell sometimes, but he does play himself. Last class, he was playing himself in Battle for Moscow. So I don't know if that counts as cheating, but definitely saw some tactics there that looked interesting. We'll call them interesting.
So Lexi is a relatively new person on this journey into the professional wargaming world. What, based on you know, however expansive or limited your hobby game experience might have been, what are some of the things that you've seen so far from the hobby game world that when you get into the professional world, you're looking at it and going, oh yeah, I already kind of got that, versus what are some of the things in the professional world that were completely different, completely foreign, potentially completely counter to what you expected when you first started in that game design space?
Yeah, so I will be the first to admit that my hobby gaming experience is hobby gaming and not hobby wargaming. So really quintessential example is a lot of hobby wargamers who are also professional wargamers really enjoy role-playing games in Dungeons and Dragons, and, you know, insert your role-playing game here. I was not a fan until somebody said, hey, you really like sci-fi. We've got this sci-fi system called Delta Green, a little bit of mysticism sprinkled in there. Just have a couple beers, play a game, and we're sure there'll be something for you to pull out for work. And sure enough, there was. About 3 weeks after I played the game, I'm looking at, you know, a professional game design objectives and said, you know what, we could really get after this using some sort of role-playing game system. And so that really helped. For me, what makes the transition from a hobby game to a professional game is less about, oh, here's a nice mechanic, here's how accurate it is. It's more about how intuitive it is, because as Sebastian had said, a lot of times when you are designing professional games, your lowest common denominator will be more similar to my background, where you grew up playing Monopoly rather than Next War Poland. And while families will still get into fights, whether you're playing Monopoly or Next War Poland, just very different game systems. And so you have to try and create that and recreate those moments.
At least with Next War Poland, the point is to get into a fight, isn't it? So
you obviously have never put rent on Park Place with your siblings then.
Oh, no. I have. It's funny you mentioned Delta Green. That does bring up an unrelated but always humorous anecdote. I don't know if you're aware of it. I think Chris probably knows about it. Sebastian might. There is actually a published biography of Julia Child out there, a nonfiction book that claims that she was a member of Delta Green while in World War II. And it's because some chucklehead did his research on the internet and found some fan fiction site of Julia Child in World War II was actually undercover for Delta Green while serving in the military or whatever it was that she did during World War II. Somebody baked that into something on the web somewhere. Lots of other people repeated it and linked to it because they thought it was kind of funny to build that into the backstory for the in-game chronology. But some yutz actually published it in a nonfiction book as a part of her biography, mentioning her service during World War II, that she was a part of this covert unit called Delta Green. I've always loved that anecdote about that game.
She was part of the OSS.
Yes. But that got in the fan fiction world of, you know, sort of online talking about role-playing games, somebody had made a comment about, you know, her being a part of Delta Green within OSS, and somebody writing a biography of Julia Child took a throwaway line that got linked to a lot of places with other game sites and included it in the book.
That is fantastic. And I have to say that I also thought it was entirely appropriate when Lexi, the first thing I thought of when Lexi said that she had played Delta Green and it was applicable to her day job was, yeah, I've worked at places where a Lovecraftian horror RPG would be applicable as well.
Within the professional game design context, we had talked some about where some of those similarities are. Obviously, the differences are huge, in no small measure, because there are ginormous differences between we're using this to help make decisions about national defense policy and giant budget decisions and potential national strategy implications versus we're having some fun with beer and pretzels. But within sort of some nuanced space between there, Sebastian, what are some of those places where you're seeing some of those differences between the hobby guys, hey, let's have fun, but let's have fun with a relatively complex model that's trying to give us some fidelity to the real world when we're talking wargaming, versus some of those professional games that you've been involved in over the years, and some of those differences in approach for what goes into them, what comes out of them?
So one of the first things I would say is the biggest difference between sort of commercial hobby gaming and professional series gaming, whether that be wargaming or otherwise, is the fact that you have a sponsor and that you're often looking at a question or trying to achieve a training and learning objective, what we call a TLO. So with those cases, it's really about trying to find some kind of insight or dynamic or explore a problem analytically and to produce new information to often that what leads into what, you know, Perla mentions all the time, the cycle of analysis. When it comes to educational games, that is where you get a little more closer to what you get with commercial games. Nonetheless, there's a bit of differences because you are focusing on a particular theme or topic or learning objective that, for example, I want to teach these captains how to do fire and maneuver, or teach these majors how to do a staff process of doing fires or logistics. And there's a specific goal in mind in the gameplay. While commercial games are focused on entertainment and enjoyment and all those things are good and professional educational games, because engagement often creates iterations and often builds what we call the magic circle, but it is not the only purpose.
Chris, what do you think? Riff off of that a little.
You know, I was just about to, I was reaching for the microphone to say, can I riff off of that a little? Yeah, I would agree with everything that Sebastian said there. I would add the idea that the big difference I see is that, especially on analytic type games, is that the white cell, the control cell that's running the game, is trying to achieve an objective. They're, you know, their job is to achieve the objective. And you've got blue players and red players and maybe some other colored players in there also. The red players are very much a creature of the white cell, and the blue players are too. And by that, I mean, if the play isn't going in a place that's going to answer those objectives, then the white cell has to generally step in and sort of push it to go in that place. Now, I'm not saying we know what the outcome we want is, so you got to put your thumb on the scale to get the outcome you want. What I am saying is, sometimes you got to tell players, like, yeah, that's a fantastic idea, but don't do that, because I need, in order to get the data that I want this game to generate, I need you to go in a particular direction. And if you don't sort of go down that path, then we'll never get to the point where we actually learn the stuff that we need to learn. We'll never generate the data. You can't analyze data that you don't generate. And so you need to, the game needs to generate the data. When I worked at the Naval War College, I was part of a game project up there that's been running for close to 20 years now. And their solution was, is that they had the faculty advisors were both the blue national command authorities and the red national command authorities. So both sides had to go do mother may I's to the faculty advisors to get permission to do things. And sometimes the answer was, that's a great idea, we'll add it to the list. Some other class of students will explore that idea sometime in the future, but I need you guys to do this other thing instead. And that leads to some other interesting decisions that you sometimes make. I mean, sometimes what you do is you break the game into pieces, and you're not really doing a game that goes, that starts at the beginning and goes all the way to the end. You're looking at individual slices of it, because those are the parts that are interesting. Those are the parts that are going to generate the data for you. There was something in specific I was going to think of in that regard. But that's not really the way that the commercial games approach that. I know of at least one gaming organization, professional gaming organization, that the methodology that they've come up with, it's using a computer-based game called Command PE, that is the professional edition, that's the PE part, of Command Modern Operations. And so the idea is that they, instead of run, when they turn the game loose and they sort of let it run by itself, they'll let it like run overnight. When they let it run like that, it's not one instantiation of the game, they run five. And generally one of them has some problems and there's a couple that are like not quite what they want. And then they come in the next day and they look at the various runs and they go, that's the one that best meets our objective. And so that's the one we'll hand back to the players for them to respond to do the next turn. It's really all about generating the data if you're doing an analytic game. If you're doing an educational game, it's about meeting the educational objectives. If you're doing a training game, it's about meeting the training objectives. Education and training games are different. They're similar, but a lot of people sort of lump them together. But, you know, training games are about learning how to do a particular task. Educational games are about learning how to think.
I've characterized that distinction in the past, and we've had a video on our site where I was talking about sort of using games and simulations for education and training, and that one of the big distinctions in there is that there's a difference between new skill acquisition versus existing skill rehearsal, right? One of them is, I don't know how to do something, please teach me how to do it. And the other one is, I already know how to do it, I'm practicing it, or practicing it in context and in concert with other skills that are mutually reinforcing or supporting as I go forward. So yeah, those are definitely some distinctions there. you've mentioned, Chris, this idea of the analytical war game, and John Compton obviously is sort of the current champion of analytical wargaming to a lot of the public. He's got some great videos out there about it. That said, I think that's a topic that is heavily misunderstood among the hobby community when looking at what the pros might try to do. Can you give us, look, recognizing that John has spent literally hours on this and there are still some people that don't get it, can you do it in 3 minutes or less?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. At least I can tell you what I think the big thing that people miss in all this is that it's not about the outcome of the game, which is not to say don't pay attention to the outcome of the game, right? If blue loses all the time, then, you know, you need to be asking yourself, why does blue always lose? But it's not about the outcome of the game. It's about the data that you generate along the way. There's insights in that data. Peter Perla, in his book, The Art of Wargaming, which I think came out in 1990, Peter used to be my boss when I worked at CNA. But Peter would talk about how wargame analysis is not, it's not like operations research. It's not a quantitative thing. It's like historical analysis. So wargames can function as artificial history. Just like it's interesting to know who won, you know, the Civil War, but it's not like you go to a Civil War class on the Civil War, you walk in the first day and the professor says, so the North won, any questions? All right, then we're done, right? There's a lot of devil in the details, and you if you go approach it like that, you don't know why the North won. So war games are about generating, analytic war games are about generating data that you can then run through the whatever analysis process you do, and you can gain insights from it. And sometimes you gain more insights if you get spanked.
Sebastian, taking a look at some of your experience with the analytical wargaming versus some sort of training or learning type of game, what's been your experience with analytical wargaming, and where has your background with hobby gaming helped inform some of what you've done in an analytical space, not just a learning and training space?
So one of the things I will say, jumping on what Chris said, is it's all about context. I always tell people that war games, unlike models and simulations and other analytical tools, they're all about the contextual decision-making. The first time you play a game is not the same gameplay. You don't do the same moves as you do at the second or the 20th or the 30th time. And it's the same for professional war games. You're really trying to understand the context of the decision of what drove people into understanding a certain threat perspective or making a certain risk calculation. And that's really the juice that you're trying to squeeze out of the players and their expertise and their experiences by using the game and its choices.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I think that idea of the analytical game is probably one of the biggest areas that the hobby guys don't necessarily get. And the idea that, you know, Chris, quoting Peter Perla, this idea of artificial histories that you can then go back and examine the why, I think is really important given the context in which those professional games operate. But I think it's potentially a place where the hobby guys maybe lose a little bit. Like that's definitely somewhere that they could really dig into a little bit more for a better understanding of what's happening in front of them in those games. Lexi, any thoughts you want to chime in there with?
My day job is personally pretty much all analytical wargaming. Sebastian will tell you that I'm not used to being in person classes, and there have been many back of the classroom hemming and hawing about educational war games, because I'm a big believer in getting to the answers through analytical war games. And I will say this, going off a little bit of what Chris had said, a lot of times it's not about the nature of the war game being analytical and trying to drive towards a solution, but it's about who you have there, and it's about your white cell and the analysis that they are able to do on that war game. So if all four of us were playing a game and I noticed, you know, Sebastian is moving twice as fast as Chris, I might say, hey, Sebastian's decision speed is faster than Chris's. But that's something that I, as the facilitator or white cell, would analyze and include in my post-game follow-up as an insight that had come from it. So I really think there's benefit in having someone kind of this third party observing whatever your analytical game or whatever even your educational or game for fun is in providing that.
That brings up an interesting point in that generally your white cell folks are there to facilitate the game and keep it running itself. This idea of having almost an ethnographic observer in the room looking at what's going on besides just the execution of the game, I think is something that I haven't seen happen very often in some of the professional war games where I've been involved. The caveat to that, of course, is that I wasn't ever working in an analytical context. All of the ones I was in were in more of a training and education context. So I do think that that's kind of a neat idea of have that fly on the wall that's, you know, observing and reporting without necessarily being involved in the execution of the game. Obviously, if you're short on people, somebody's got to wear multiple hats. And let's face it, we all always seem to be short on people, don't we? So
that's something that I did pretty consistently when I was up in Newport. It wasn't just me. I mean, that was just sort of the way that we did it. We always had somebody in the room with a notebook. And I'm a big believer in having somebody in the room with a notebook. First of all, that guards against there being some sort of other data collection failure, right? If you lose your network goes away, your server room catches on fire and take all the data with it, you've still got people in their notebooks. And it also captures the stuff that move sheets don't capture. And that's things like, you know, Captain Schmuckatelli totally dominated the conversation and everybody else just kind of checked out and let him do what he wanted to. So the moves that you're seeing are not the moves of the blue cell, they're the moves of Captain Schmuckatelli. Or this one actually happened in an event that I was doing that role for. They spent half their time on the first quarter of the move, and they spent a quarter of their time on the second quarter of the move, and then they spent a quarter of their time on the last half of the move. And so there was lots of places where, as they're going through, they'd say, oh, you know, we should have thought of that up front, but we don't have time to go back and put it up there. And I just say, got it. I'll fix it in the post game.
As Armchair Dragoons continue the seventh season of Mentioned in Dispatches, we need to take a moment to thank those Patreon supporters who pledged at the regimental patron level. So a special thank you to Patrick Mullen, Hethwill Wargames, Steelgrave, Mike Quigley, Staggerwing, Robert, Joseph Knoll, Treb Curry, Kevin Bertram, and Patrick Garrity for their support of Armchair Dragoons and helping us bring you the best wargaming content on the web. You can join our Patreon supporters at patreon.com/armchairdragoons.
When we're looking at some of the differences in the actual design as well as the execution, the adjudication ends up being one of those big buzzwords in the professional world that I think some of the hobby guys don't always have a great grasp of. When we're talking about the adjudication of a particular war game, the hobby guys are thinking, what, like the CRT? Let's get the combat results table out. I got some dice. What am I adjudicating? Like, this factor beats that factor. Here's my dice. I've got 5-1 odds. As long as I don't roll a one, I'm good. And there's your adjudication model right there. Obviously, in the professional world, it's a little more complex. And so when we start talking about what does adjudication mean in a professional context, and what can you take from the hobby world to help make that a little better or streamline it some, versus what are some adjudication needs in the professional world that there's just no equivalent of in the hobby world? Hey, Sebastian, what are some of the things you've seen, maybe some of the things you actually teach to your students on the differences here and what you can use from the hobby world versus what you just cannot get away with from the hobby world?
So it depends on the type of game you're making. For a lot of the tactical operational games, I found that war game designers, even the professional world, draw inspiration and play draws a lot of commercial games. You know what I mean? How do I do movement and fire, combat result tables? How do I do hidden movement or deception? Or how do I incorporate cyber or other morale effects? In those regards, it is more common to use commercial board gaming mechanics. And it's also one of the reasons I feature it so much, because many of the war games the students produce in my class are either operational or tactical. In terms of the strategic war games or policy war games, they tend to be less so. They don't look like commercial games. They look more like role-playing games in some regards, but even that is a bit of a stretch at times, mainly because in those games, they are trying to replicate and represent a particular real-life process or organization or prerogatives that is sort of unique to DoD. And that requires a specific type of design. It's often oral-based or cell-based, where they're trying to produce products for the white cell to sort of look at. And it's sort of like you're having the players in a zoo, and the game is a zoo, and the white cell is both the observers and the sort of the puppet masters in building the world in which they exist and react to.
Lexi, thoughts?
Yeah, so going off of a little bit of what both Chris and Sebastian have said about game objectives, a lot of times just ripping a CRT or, a pawn tracker, et cetera, from a commercial game will get the job done, especially if your game objective is to find facts, create ideas, that sort of thing. For me, when I look at my design timeline of anywhere from 2 to 6 weeks and how condensed it is, I might as well just, let somebody else who's done the research, let somebody else who's the expert on, special operations in Poland, again, referencing next war Poland, and just pull their CRT, right? Because that's not the objective of my game is not to determine how great, operations in Poland are. The objective of my game is to create new ideas. So in a lot of ways, I think hobby games lend themselves well to being intuitive and having good adjudication methods that can supplement professional games.
Yeah. Chris, you've done pretty much every kind of adjudication there possibly is to adjudicate in the professional world. Do you want to adjudicate about adjudication methods?
Well, I should hasten to add that most of the time I was the analyst, so I'm standing next to the people that are actually doing the adjudication. I'm not actually doing it myself. That having been said, a lot of it really sort of depends upon what kind of data that you want to get out of it. And, a lot of it also depends upon what sort of time frame you have. If I'm having to run through a bunch of scenarios very quickly, it might end up being a very simple matrix type game that's being it's somebody's just sort of doing it off the cuff based upon what they think would be a likely outcome of a particular situation. I mean, the Marines are sort of famous for they play their games down at Quantico. They've done a lot of games where they sort of self-adjudicate, where you've got the Marines on either side of a particular thing. They say, okay, here's the reasons why I think this is going to work for me. Well, okay, here's the reasons why I think you might have a problem. And then they just basically talk it out real quickly and come to a resolution. And, sometimes it's hard to do. Sometimes it's easy to do. I've seen games where they use something like Command PE, and it really is like you're playing a computer game, but you're getting input from professionals on either side. You've got some other tools. I've seen other games where it's basically just it's somebody standing at the front of the room going, all right. A friend of mine tells a story about the first time he went to global. He was going to be an ASW adjudicator for global. And so he put together a binder full of probability tables and this and that and the other thing. And he gets there, and the guy who was running that cell is a now retired ONI guy named Dennis Cowan. And Dennis just sort of looked at him and said, all right, there were 4 submarine attacks. One submarine was sunk, 2 were no effect, and the 3rd one was driven off. And Paul's just sort of like looking at his binder, like, why did I bring, it's like, that's because Paul didn't understand that the purpose of the game wasn't to play it through in such a way as to get to, they weren't going to follow a path, even if the path ended up being weird, because that wasn't going to meet the game objectives. The game objectives were just sort of looking at averages was good enough for the game objectives. I should say, this is actually a good place to say this. People need to understand the difference between modeling and simulation on the one hand and wargaming on the other hand. They're related tools, but they are not the same tool. There's a lot of modeling and sim people who in the past just sort of viewed wargaming as being bad modeling and sim, but they're really kind of aiming at different objectives. If you need the war game to produce a number, right, then you're probably not actually looking for a war game. You're looking for something like AFSIM or some other modeling and sim program that can, you can grind it through, you know, 500 times, and it'll tell you exactly what that probability distribution looks like. And that's a pretty good place to get that information. If what you're looking for is what human decision-making happens, right? It's all about the humans in it. So you're really kind of inherently looking for stuff that's a lot more qualitative in that regard. And so wargaming can help you with that problem. I have that happen all the time where people say, oh, I want to do a war game to do such and such. And it's like, tell me more about that. Yeah, you don't want a war game. You want modeling and sim. You should probably go, we can have a conversation about whether you should do the modeling and sim piece first and then do a wargaming piece afterwards or vice versa. But the problem you just described is really a modeling and sim problem. This is one of the reasons why if you're doing, especially if you're doing an analytical game, but for any game, you really need to sit down and analyze the objectives. And if you skip that analyzing the objective stuff, you're, you know, take the money out in the parking lot and just set it on fire because you're not getting your money's worth.
You're channeling your inner Stephen Downs Martin there with what's the objective? Who's the sponsor? When are you leaving? Why don't you have this information already? You know, it's
you're
asking a lot of his classic questions there.
If you're doing this right, you start with the research with a problem. You've defined that problem until you make sure that you understand it. Right? You have to go back and forth with the sponsor because usually they can't articulate their exact problem. You figure out what their problem is. Then you start thinking in terms of objectives. And then you start thinking in terms of what are the research questions that come out of those objectives. And then you think in terms of what data do I need to generate to be able to answer those questions. And somewhere after that step, you start designing the war game.
Yeah, yeah. And
sometimes people have been doing it for a while. It looks like they're skipping those steps, but in reality, they're kind of doing it in the back of their head. But I've seen plenty of other instances where even people who should know better just skip those steps and go right to designing. And it's like, yeah, okay. Once again, take the money out in the parking lot and just set it on fire.
Yeah. Whereas in the hobby game world, the guy or gal who's designing that game, oh, I'm interested in this topic, therefore I will explore it through game design rather than, you know, I've got a sponsor who has required a particular thing with a particular objective. So that's definitely the purpose of the design is certainly a gigantic difference in the hobby world versus that professional world. So Lexi, you want to jump in here with some questions?
I do. I don't think it would be a podcast or a webinar or anything I'm in without me bombarding it with questions. So for Chris, when we talk about blind adjudication and we talk about incorporating players, blurring the lines, etc., have you had any experiences where you're like, you know what, I wish this was just a game rule book in a box and I did not have to explain the adjudication because it would just be given to players and say, like a hobby game. You don't have to interact. This is what it is. We're not changing it.
The short answer is yes. The longer answer is most of the games I've been involved with, once I got to the War College, the War College does a different kind of game. The stuff I designed when I was at CNA that I was part of the design team for was a lot closer to looking like a traditional game that you could buy and, you know, take home and play at home. And as a result, you know, there had to be a pretty solid rule book, et cetera, et cetera. You couldn't just have stuff in the heads of the designers or the adjudicators, et cetera, like you can if you're running a, you know, something like Global, right? So from that standpoint, you know, I've been in sort of both camps. And having to write out a rule book both makes things easier and makes it harder, because writing rules is hard. I mean, one of the things I noticed over the years is every now and then I'd be on a gaming mailing list, and somebody would say something like, oh, you know, the game is like 90% done. I just have to write the rules. And every time I hear that, it's like, boy, you know, to quote Wolfgang Pauli, that's not even wrong, right? This guy just doesn't get it if he thinks that writing the rules is this little step you do at the end. Because every single time I've sat down to write the rules, we've always discovered that there's some big issue that we hadn't thought through, or, you know, the conceptualization of the rules that I had was not the same as what the other people that were playing it had. And you discover, you know, this is one of the dangers of you sometimes see this in commercial game companies, where if the playtesters have too much access to the designers, they're not getting what's in the rule book. They're getting what's in the designer's head. And as a result, you know, the rules can be all jacked up. So rule books are hard, but they also solve a lot of problems too.
I completely agree. So quick backstory. One of the issues that my Zenobia design team had was we had this great idea. We could talk to this idea about how things would interact in our game system. We went to put it down on paper and create this rule book. We realized we have about 12 decks of cards and a bidding mechanic in a 2-hour time limit. This just doesn't work. But it took that additional step of saying, hey, what's in our head makes sense. Let's write it down in a rule book for us to say, this doesn't work out. And I think this is a huge part of how Sebastian actually teaches his wargaming class that, yes, I'm currently in. But Sebastian, if you want to talk to that a little bit, I think that's the design journal and rule book piece of it.
So we just had the recent lecture about turning your research into schemas, that underlying model that underscores all games, whether they be commercial or professional. And I always teach the students to build small, build out, and then build up. I found it similar to like coding. You don't want to build the whole game system and see if it works, because you don't know where the flaw is. You want to build in small iterations, sort of the design design thinking philosophy, and sort of small bits. And as you build small and build out and build up, you can track where the flaws are and remedy those problems as they arise throughout the process. And you sort of, it's an iterative process that, you know, Chris and Lexi all have done in their own professional lives. You know what I mean? I had it in my own professional career where we have play tested it with someone, and some expert will say, hey, like, this is not how, you know, pick a thing like submarines or airplanes work, or you miss this process, or I know this says this in the doctrine, but that's not how we do it in real life. And then you have to go back and fix whatever the problem is. And that is true for professional games as it is in commercial games. But one of the big differences, I think, is in the professional world, we don't write many rule books. You know, and Chris has mentioned like places like CNA and other places do more so. And that's an organizational reflection about the types of games and the types of rule sets they produce. But in many places, we don't share those things. Even if you see a report about war games, like at Rand and other places, they won't tell you how they designed their game, nor the compromises, nor the research that went into it. They'll just say, this is, we ran a game, this is the general overview of the game, and this is how we did it. They won't publish the CRTs or any of that, mainly because the game designs themselves are sort of treated as like trade secrets. And you're not allowed to like walk away with them, and they don't want to share it. And that's a big difference, I think, in the professional wargaming community and the commercial community, where you steal and borrow and get inspired, and there's a lot of exchange of knowledge in the commercial realm, but there's not so much that in the professional realm. It's very treated much like a trade secret.
What's interesting is you're mentioning them kind of as trade secrets. I think for a lot of hobbyists that aren't familiar with the professional realm, one of the things that's probably the default assumption that they would fall back on is, hey, they can't share this because there's some sort of classified data involved. in my experience at least, has been no, there's very little classified data involved, because the hoops you have to jump through to vet participants into a game with classified data becomes so high that it almost negates the purpose of trying to bring them all together for a war game in the first place. So it has nothing to do with the classification of the data and everything to do with, like you mentioned, this trade secrets. We don't want somebody ripping off our ideas and go and sell our ideas to the government for themselves.
That really kind of depends upon the organization and depends on the exact topic of the war game, because there's a lot of instances where you end up with things being classified just by naming the country involved, and then you end up with, you know, if you're using the latest intelligence data and stuff like that. Now, I've been arguing for years now that we frequently don't need to do that. Or we don't need to be so focused on the exact capabilities of and the exact numbers of foreign systems, for instance. If we're doing modeling and sim stuff, then yeah, you need to get it out to at least one decimal place. But if you're not, if you're doing something that looks more like a war game and it's really more about the human decision making, I don't necessarily need that level of detail. I can get by with these guys have something that's hypersonic and it goes, let's call it Mach 4 or Mach 5. And, you know, you can just sort of do that and then do a game that way and see what happens. But a lot of people are really seduced by the data. I see that all the time. It's like, oh, you know, unless you've got this high quality data at the three decimal places, it's not worth it. It's like, okay, do you really get a better outcome that way? Sometimes, yes. But it's not automatic that you get a better outcome that way.
No, from a business perspective, it's a better outcome for them because it allows them to sell additional services to the government for all that independent validation and verification.
Yeah, for things like that, the different Beltway bandits sort of treat that stuff differently. Like I've had Booz Allen people tell me, oh, no, I can't give you a copy of that because that's that one page thing is proprietary. Whereas, you know, CNA, they everything they do is for the government and they just sort of, here you go. If you own it now, you tell me if we're going to distribute it or not. And it's literally, I was in a meeting today where it's like, yeah, go ahead, give it to them.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. Their answer is, I can't, you know, I have to ask the sponsor, and sometimes the sponsor might not want to let that out. Sometimes that's for political reasons. Political being defined very broadly, right? I don't mean Democrats versus Republicans. I mean, it's like, okay, this is a pre-decisional thing, and, you know, we need to control the messaging on this, so we're not going to dump this out to the outside world just yet until we can have an opportunity to sort of control that messaging. But in other times it's like, yeah, sure, give it to them.
Yeah, I don't feel like having to answer an email from Michael Peck just yet, so let's wait a little while before we release this.
Yeah, exactly. But and it really kind of varies depending upon who it is. Some people treat it like it's this deep dark trade secret, whereas one of the things I like about the CNA approach is that the CNA approach is really the CNA approach is the MIT approach, which is they put all their syllabi online, because if you ask them, they'll say, I don't think anybody out there thinks that you can get an MIT education just by reading the books and looking at the syllabus, right? You know, you need a world-class expert in the room doing it. And so if your thing is we've got world-class experts that can design our game for you, yeah, sure, we'll go ahead and show it to you. No problem. Yeah. But you need to hire us because we're the world-class experts.
I want to turn some of this whole approach that we've taken so far in the discussion and flip it on its head here a little bit. Because so far what we've done is we've talked a lot about the approaches within the professional space that are different from the hobbyist, that the hobbyist wouldn't necessarily understand, or it's so different from hobby gaming as a pastime activity, as a leisure activity, that some of the things in the professional realm are almost irrelevant to the hobby world. Knowing full well that many of the professional game designers out there in the professional practitioner world have shelves of hobby games on, you know, in their houses at home, and that you'd be hard pressed to find very many professional gamers who are not also hobbyists. What are some places where you've seen that the professional world either didn't necessarily adapt a good lesson from the hobby world? What's some places where the professional world could be better informed by the hobbyists, could take advantage of or leverage some approaches that the hobbyists are taking? Sebastian, you've done a bunch of stuff lately. You know, your Fleet Marine Force game that you're busy, you know, hand assembling kits for, to an untrained eye, looks a whole lot like a hobby war game out there. There's some professional context to it. What are some places where maybe some hobby things aren't being leveraged into the professional world quite as well as they could be?
So the first thing I would say is the use of technology. I think the hobby world is doing such interesting things with phone apps like U-Boat, which is a war game brand, but also other things like even Vassal, or even creating tabletop simulator games and other, or even like AI, simple AI versions of their games to teach games. I think that is a huge thing that the commercial realm is way ahead of us in the professional realm. And that's partly because of the way the fiscal cycle works and the cycle and lifetime of our games are, but also a part of it's like IT technical challenge of getting the funding to do something like that. So I think there are places in the professional realm and the DoD that are making strides in trying to change that. The U.S. Fight Club, which is a spinoff of the U.K. Fight Club, which is an educational wargaming institution for officers and enlisted for professional military education and training, is trying to solve some of that problems. And they've been doing some great work with using commercial digital games. But I think that is something that we as professional wargamers need to do better at, especially in this era of COVID and thing of distributed workforces, is that how can we turn our games into more interactive ways to be multimedia, but also leverage other technologies out there, whether that be AR or just phone apps, or, you know, like just to be able to do combat result tables, you know what I mean, on your phone app. I think that is super clever. I think we need to be able to tap into those things.
How much of that do you think is the government's default position of maximum network paranoia versus, a funding issue or a creativity issue? Because in the past, like, even one of the projects that I worked on years ago with the NDU, we were building a web-based interface for the game that we were working on for them. But even that one, we had to host that off-site and just had everybody log into it through a web browser in order to be able to use it, because the 18-month approval cycle through the IT security folks was, you know, for a game that was going to be running 18 weeks from when we cut the contract, there was no way that we were going to get through all those approvals to get the technology inside the wire. So it was a lot easier to just stand up a third party host, have everybody log into that website and run through there.
Yes, that is definitely a component of it, is the notion that there's always a balance between cybersecurity and, you know what I mean, sort of accessibility. And at times I feel like we as the DoD, as a community, swing too hard to the security portion and then we forget why the internet exists, which is to pass information easily. And that's definitely been a challenge, especially in this COVID era where distributive access is important and necessary. But also at the same time, I think it's also a function of how many professional games are funded, which is based on the fiscal year. So it's hard to create a phone app or use something very innovative and sort of risk-taking in terms of technology within a 12-month cycle, where you spend 4 months of it talking to your sponsor and doing research, and then you're trying to create a manual version of it. And then the life cycle is too short, and many games to my chagrin, are not iterative enough. We don't take games beyond their first year, because often they are now being fed into some other analytical cycle that you don't have control over. And Chris and Lexi can talk about it, but I'll pass it to Lexi first.
Yeah. So for me, when I look at what professional wargaming could be adopting from the hobby world, number one, just pizzazz. I mean, you mentioned Sebastian hand stickering Fleet Marine Force games. If somebody on a professional wargaming team listening to this has a graphic designer on their team, please contact me and let me know how you made that happen, because I've not come across one yet to this day. Along those same lines, when we get into virtual and computer-based and, oh, video games are the way of the future, to me, I think there's this lack of understanding of what goes into video game development. So one of my good friends actually was working at Blizzard right after college. And as I was getting my feet wet in war game design, I said, hey, like, how do you design a game? How do you design a video game? Like, well, it's in storyboarding for 2 years. And then we spend millions of dollars to do a prototype. And then we spend millions of dollars on marketing. And we pre-sell copies. And all I'm hearing is millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars in years. And to your point about an 18-month IT cycle, well, now you're looking at years to even develop something that's user-friendly, that has all of the attributes that a consumer would want, just to get to that proof of concept phase, much less make it accessible throughout a force, whether that's a department or a wargaming agency or club like UK Fight Club, US Fight Club. But there's just like this lack of understanding in the professional world of what goes into creating a computer-based or virtual game versus what goes into creating a video game. Those are two very different things. And so I will toss it over to Chris now for his thoughts.
So the easiest way, note, easiest is different from easy. The easiest way to do that sort of thing is to take something that already exists and repurpose it. And we see that done occasionally. There was an effort to have, there was a Harpoon Professional Edition that was based upon Harpoon 3 back in the day. It really kind of died out about 2008. They finally kind of gave up on it. And that really suffered from the fact that it was really kind of one or two guys, and they just didn't have the ability to sort of upgrade everything to the more modern operating systems. And so it looked like the cutting edge of 1990s technology. Most recently, you see Command PE, where they've taken Command and they've tried to give you the ability to put in real-world data, real-world classified data, and change the database, et cetera, et cetera. And so from that standpoint, you can actually do stuff relatively quickly if you've gone to the trouble of getting Command PE and gotten authorization to run it on your standalone systems, et cetera, et cetera. But that the downside of that is that it really kind of locks you into one kind of game, right? The Command PE community out there is, there's lots of different approaches going on. There's a lot of people that are doing it very heavily interactive, where you've got somebody sitting next to this person who's the puckster who's actually doing stuff. I saw a game where you had an Army guy and an Air Force guy sitting next to each other, giving controls, giving orders back and forth like they were talking over a radio. And with the puckster in between, sort of turning it into something that was being projected on the wall. Yeah, I previously talked about how there was the group that they run headless, and they run multiple different instantiations because it gives them variety that they can then pick from when they're trying to decide, you know, what's the best way to take the game to get to meet their analytic objectives in the next step. There's lots of different ways they can do it, but they all end up looking like a sort of standard red versus blue, marching through time. I can make the clock go faster. I can make the clock go slower, et cetera, et cetera. They all sort of play out the same way from that regard. So that's really one of the limitations of computers. I can do a lot more stuff by just having a game director at the front of the room running things. When I was at CNA, I was involved in a war game where we literally designed the war game at 2 p.m. on a Sunday afternoon, and we began execution at 9 a.m. on Monday. Now,
see, the problem with you saying that publicly, though, is that somebody's going to hear that and they're going to be calling guys like Lexi and Sebastian and going, well, Chris did that in like 18 hours.
Why? No. The difference here, right? The difference here is the players were already picked and identified, right? They had done all the other steps. They just hadn't designed the war game. And we were able to go with a very simple matrix game type approach where you're both sides are making an argument as to why they think it should work. And the person functioning as the adjudicator, as the games master, says, all right, I'm going to give it to you guys. All right, I'm going to give it to you guys. Or if you're Ed McGrady, you reach into your pocket and pull out one of the dice you have in the pocket, and you just sort of pick something as being a target number to roll against. So there's some variability in there. That works for some kinds of problems. It doesn't work for all kinds of problems. But a simple role-playing type game, which a matrix game is really just kind of a particular flavor of role-playing game, usually with map, a simple matrix game role-playing type solution is something that you can sort of throw together if you need to. If you need to, you're probably better off doing something else in a lot of instances. But, you know, everybody, all game designers have the things they sort of gravitate towards, right? I don't want to make it sound like every game designer sits down and figures out exactly what's the right tool to use for this particular situation, because no, we don't do that. Some of us are better at some things than others. Some of us lean in particular directions. Organizations are that way too. You go to RAND, you're going to get a war game that looks like a RAND war game. You go to CNA, you're going to get a game that looks like a CNA war game. You go to the War College, Naval War College, you get a game that looks like a game from Newport, right? Everybody has there's some stylistic differences there. But you do need at some point to sort of figure out, like, what's the right answer for this particular question. And so there is some variability there.
You mentioned the whole looks like, you know, red versus blue sort of, you know, ants marching across the map sort of thing that is what a lot of folks will conceptualize. Look, this is Risk, whether it's Risk digitally or whether it's Risk on a tabletop. For a lot of folks who are not familiar with wargaming, it's still, you know, this looks like Risk to them. And that's going to get some derisive looks from people that aren't familiar with wargaming in the professional world. When you start looking at some of the innovations in the hobby wargaming space that you could bring to the professional gaming space. And an example of that, several examples of that, but they're all from one guy, so they kind of become an example. Brian Train has done a variety of different irregular warfare games that do not exist on a traditional map. The sort of battlefield over which you're fighting is the realm of public opinion or the realm of influence in a particular area. When you're putting something like that in front of a professional audience who's already predisposed to take a look at Aftershock and go, oh, hey, we're playing Risk today, because they don't know any better, to really push that intellectual boundary a little further, is that something that you can even get away with in a professional context, much less have much success with that? Chris, Sebastian, either one of y'all can jump on there first, and we'll get to Lexi for that.
I can jump on that to start off with. And the answer is, it depends. It depends on the type of problem that the sponsor has. It depends upon whether the sponsor's needs are being met by the other people that they're talking to. Sometimes if they're coming to talk to you, it's like, I can't get this answer anyplace else. Hopefully you guys can help me, right? And so, you know, sometimes you get people that are kind of dismissive of the entire idea of war games. But as a general rule, those people aren't seeking out war gamers to try to give them money to develop war games for them. If the sponsor's going to be dismissive of a war game, they're probably not talking to you to begin with. And so if they can come and bring this sort of unstructured problem to you and say, hey, I need some help putting this all together, and so that you can tell me how to do this, then then yeah, sometimes you can get some traction on that. And people will run with it. Now, most of the wargaming that happens in DoD is either exercises or map X's or things like that, right? Especially if you're in the Army, you've encountered this sort of stuff. And so sometimes you've got people, you know, they're sort of standing there with their head tilted to one side because they don't quite know what to make out of this. But it's rare to get outright hostility, I think. In my experience, it's been rare to get outright hostility. It does happen occasionally. And if they're being hostile, it's always useful to ask why. I mean, I've most of the instances of outright hostility I've seen, when you pulled the thread, there was something else going on there. And they may not be able to articulate it.
Yeah.
I remember there was an event that up in Newport. This is actually when I was still at CNA, but I went up for this event in Newport, where there was this one Navy captain who was just smoking flames in the sort of structured after action report portion of it. And so Stephen Downs Martin sat down with him, and it's like, okay, I'm not understanding what your issue is. And the problem was he just wasn't able to articulate, because he didn't live in the wargaming world. And as a result, he didn't have the vocabulary to really sort of explain it. But if, when we pulled the thread, it's like, okay, are you saying, okay, I got it. All right. Thank you. That was good feedback, but we had to interpret for a while.
Yeah.
So that can happen.
Sebastian, some of what you've seen out there for those really innovative hobby game kinds of things that could be useful in a professional context that would just sort of blow people's minds.
Yeah. So I think with operations in the information environment, like OIU, what we call in the military, in terms of cyber and influence, I think that is really where some of the stuff that Brian Train and others are doing is great. And there's a game that I want to look at called Mind Management, which is a big thing in the commercial realm. And I was like, people are talking about the mechanics and the gameplay. I was like, well, how can this be applied to, you know, cyber and other war games like it? And I think often we in the DoD apply sort of infantry and combat arms analogies to domains like cyber and influence, where they are ill-suited, and they often produce the wrong kind of lessons and insights. And I think games can be powerful means to educate and open new insights and potentially provide new ways to view these challenges. And so, you know, I know there are a couple other designers who are thinking similarly. And the hope is that we get to do more of these kind of games in the future.
We're running up against time here for the podcast itself. And then I thank you guys for taking some time out, especially later in the evening like this as we are recording it. I do want to give everybody sort of an opportunity for a last trip around the table here, whether it's a question to somebody else on the panel or a thought or insight you had during this call, or just a key point or lesson or aphorism you wanted to throw out for the audience that we might not have already gotten to. And so, Lexi, I'm going to start with you. What's whether it's a burning question for one of the other guys here, or whether there's some key point that you want the audience to kind of take away from some of these differences in hobby versus professional gaming, besides your graphic design comment. I think that is spot on. That is absolutely a key thing that the professional world needs to pay a lot more attention to. What do you got for the group here on our way out the door?
I think I could sum it up in 2 points. So one is hobby world, please keep being innovative, coming up with new ideas, coming up with exciting ways, especially for tabletop games, to keep players engaged. I can't tell you how many times I wander into my local board game stores and I even just look at the box, because my closet is growing full at this point, and say, hey, that's really cool. For example, I came across a game called Everdale. It looks like Magic the Gathering in terms of mechanics, but it's got a 3D tree. I'm like, why am I not using 3D mechanics and 3D things to get my players engaged in some of my games? So please just keep being innovative, hobby gamers, and coming up with interesting ways to keep players engaged. And the second thing that I'll say is recognize that professional wargamers have this professional integrity that comes with existing in this space, where a lot of time we want to say, okay, this would really work better, or we would prefer this. There, it is our job to guide our consumers or clients to the best solution possible. And a lot of times that is not the easiest solutions. A lot of times that is not the most user-friendly solution, but it is the solution that consumer needs. So I'll go back to what Chris said. A lot of times consumers come to me and they say, hey, I want to figure out how many, you know, tanks, for example, I need in this fight. I say, I can't answer that for you. And due to my professional integrity, I don't want us to sit down and play, you know, World of Tanks for 4 hours. I'd rather you go visit a modeling and sim shop. So as much as we want to keep playing fun tank games, a lot of times it is not in our purview to do so. I'll leave it with that. Thank you.
Sebastian?
I will end with the notion that we, as a wider DoD wargaming community, need to publish more games. I think Rand with Hegemony, with McWill and the Marine Corps publishing Assassin's Mace, I think those are all really good, both for analytical and educational purposes. And I think other organizations like Naval War College and CGSC, and hopefully we'll get some games published here, even at Goose, for educational purposes in the future. But I think that will help collaboration and creativity and innovation happen across the community, but more so in terms of my soapbox issue about educational games, to get educational and training games in the hands of the fleet of the operating forces, and not have it only be in the NCR and the DoD small inner sanctum of circles. I think we need to get games out in the hands of the vast majority of our force.
You've sort of picked at, unintentionally picked at, a bit of a scab that I've had for a long time with the DoD in terms of how do you inculcate wargaming much broader across the force? And honestly, for me, it all comes back to the schoolhouses. Like, from the moment you start that initial professional development, probably not in basic training for brand new recruits, but whether it's your initial officer training, whether it's the basic school for the Marines, or your officer basic course for the Army, or whether it's, you know, your initial NCO courses as that rising E3, E4, very early on in the enlisted career. Wargame at all of those courses, such that it becomes an expected part of every course, that by the time you're an E7 going into some advanced NCO course or some petty officer course, like, you're expecting to see 2 and 3 and 4 war games during the course of that instruction while you're there, for all sorts of purposes. And that, you know, getting people to do lots more wargaming has got to start at the schoolhouse, and those expectations have to be set there, that this is a normal part of our training and our professional development. And then that will force you to train the trainers, that will force those guys to take those good ideas back to their regular forces, whether they're out in the fleet somewhere, out in a line unit somewhere. That taking that expectation from the training realm back to the operational forces is only going to happen if you're bombarded with it in a training environment. That's my personal soapbox on that one. Chris, parting shot here.
I guess what I would say as a parting shot is that I'd recommend a couple of readings. One is there's a book that I'm very fond of called Rules of Play by Katie Salen and Eric Zimmerman. It came out maybe 15 years ago, a little bit more than 15 years ago now. And it's
I had it in my PhD studies.
Yeah, it 2003-ish. It came out while I was at CNA. But the thing about it is, the thing that I like about that book, it's a little abstract, right? It's abstract in that regard, and a lot of professionals might look at it and say, you know, DoD wargamers might look at it and say, it's a book that uses tic-tac-toe as a recurring example, etc. But it's good about, you know, it talks about player engagement. It talks about how players can screw up your game. It talks about, basically, it's a great book if you've done your game and all the mechanics work and it's just not fun. It's a really good game to help a book to help you figure out why your game isn't any fun. And then there's something else that I'm going to recommend, something that I wrote back when I was at CNA. I wrote a paper on war game pathologies that I did not know when I wrote it that it was the thing that I was going to be known for in the professional wargaming community. But it's the thing I keep coming back to. It's the thing I keep getting asked to do talks on, et cetera, et cetera. And so from that standpoint, just do a search for my last name and war game pathologies, and you should be able to find it, to download it from the CNA website or other places.
We'll link to this podcast along with your talk you gave to Goose about pathologies.
Yeah, that sounds perfect. Cause the thing is, it's one of the war games go bad, and I was trying to solve the problem of, you know, giving people a checklist, teaching people how war games can go bad so that you can identify where the failure points are before they go bad. And I guess the last thing I would add is one of the conclusions from that paper, which is you can never have too many office supplies. And I am not joking.
That applies to game conventions as well.
Yeah, because at some point somebody, you know, at some point, somebody's going to come and say, hey, you know, we'd like to, do you have any butcher paper? Because we'd like to draw on the board or do something like that. Or, you know, there's always something like that. Post-it notes, et cetera, et cetera. Give the players the tools they need to organize their thoughts. And sometimes they'll just sit at a computer and do it. And sometimes they'll write out notes longhand. And sometimes they're flinging post-it notes on the wall.
Sharpies and post-it notes. You can never have Sharpies too many of those two things.
Yeah. But test your Sharpies every now and then to make sure they haven't dried out.
good advice also. Folks, thank you very much for taking some time to join me on this conversation. I hope there's some good info in here for the audience. I know I always learn something when I've got, you know, folks like Chris and Sebastian on there. Lexi, it was great to finally meet you after, you know, seeing you talk on a couple of things here and there, like at Connections. So it was great to have you here, and always glad to have, you know, Goose representation hanging out with the Dragoons. Even though Sebastian's not going to invite us back to any naval games since you know, the guys on horseback managed to win the naval war game tournament. So thank you very much for joining us. Audience, thank you for joining us. Really appreciate you guys being here. So thanks, everybody, and we'll catch you next time around.